Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 383. This month is a little bit of a catch-up month, and so the questions this week are taken from guide 449 and 450. That's on the Juno class and the French cruiser De Grasse. The Wednesday videos on the SBD Dauntless and the destruction of USS Maine, and the Friday video on Prince Henry of Portugal, also known as Henry the Navigator. So let's get on with questions. Almirante Brown asks, under what scenarios did Japan's strategy of combining carrier and land-based airstrikes at the Battle of the Marianas have any chance of inflicting major losses on the US Navy? It seems like a doomed plan, as the US Navy could, and did, maul the air bases before the carriers could get into position. Would the outcome have been any different if the Japanese had redeployed the aircraft at Truk to Guam and neighbouring islands before Operation Hailstone wiped them out? And should Japan have chosen the Philippines instead of the Marianas for the last stand of their carrier force so they could disperse ground-based aircraft across more air bases on a bigger landmass? So we've sort of looked at alternate ways that the Battle of Philippine Sea could have gone, but if we want to concentrate exclusively on how the airstrikes could be made to work, you have to factor a number of different changes in it. I don't think there's any one change that you could realistically make which would really, you know, boost the Japanese Navy's chances of inflicting, as you say, severe losses on the US Navy, or major losses. Going for the Philippines itself as opposed to the Mariana Islands would seem to have some attraction, but the fact is that by the time the US got there, their carrier fleet would be larger. The Japanese carrier fleet wasn't really growing at any particular pace at that point, and they kind of knew that. Plus, also, at least with the Battle of the Philippine Sea or Marianas Turkey Shoot, you roughly knew where the US fleet was going to be. Whereas one of the big problems would be if the US attacked the Philippines, as you can kind of see with the Battle of Leyte Gulf, you've kind of got to work out where exactly they're going to attack. And then you have to get around the Philippines themselves to attack them, which does make your lines of approach somewhat more predictable. So without, you know, reaching out into the ether and plucking things completely from the realms of unreality, if I was going to come up with a situation whereby the Japanese could conceivably have inflicted major losses on the US Navy at the Great Marianas Turkey Shoot, I think these are the things you'd have to change. Firstly, you would have to have the Japanese not keep training up carrier air groups and then sending them into battles where they're based on land. So after the Guadalcanal campaign, you train your carrier air groups, you keep your carrier air groups on your carriers, and you keep developing those pilot skills. So essentially replacing as best you can the skilled pilots that you've lost at Midway and during the Guadalcanal campaign. Next would be change your codes. Now, this may be a certain degree of hindsight here, but personally, I mean, even to be honest, with the lessons of the First World War, if I was in charge of somebody's signals intel, I would be using either brand new code set or at least a brand new secondary layer of encryption for every major operation. So, yeah, okay, maybe you can't persuade the powers that be to change your primary form of encryption for your entire fleet, but you could at least introduce a temporary additional layer of encryption. So you encrypt your message, whatever it happens to be, using your short-term encryption, and then you encrypt that message into the general encryption. And it essentially would be kind of like a slightly more extended use of one-time pads, where the decryption techniques for that particular day or that particular week or month or whatever would be carried aboard the ships assigned to that operation and that operation only. So if your opponent uses their normal signals intel and decrypts things, they go, well, this is a bunch of gibberish. And yeah, maybe they can crack that particular coding, but especially if you issue them with a set of daily pads, so, you know, this is the secondary encryption for today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day, it's going to badly affect the enemy's ability to read your code signals, which in turn means that your attack might come as a little bit more of a surprise. Now, of course, you could also go with have better ASW, because that is ultimately what does in for Taiho and Shikaku, but let's be fair, that's kind of A, random luck of fortune of war, and B, asking the Japanese to have extensive, effective anti-submarine warfare screens for their carrier fleets is a very big change compared to even the stuff I've mentioned earlier. And then the final change I think you'd have to make that could conceivably be within the realms of plausibility is that Spruance somehow gets persuaded by Mitscher to charge at the Japanese with his carriers to get into strike range and launch, because, of course, Essexes and so forth operating at full speed to launch aircraft are going to be faster than the fast battleship line of Admiral Lee, which means he can't maintain his forward skirmish line without, you know, causing all sorts of problems. That would result in some very interesting course charts, because, of course, the wind was coming from the east, so as you'd had historically, the US ships keep having to double back to launch aircraft, but nonetheless. And I think if you had those three changes, so the Americans are less aware of what the Japanese plan is, so perhaps they don't hit the various outlying airfields as hard. I mean, they'll probably hit them anyway as a matter of general principle, but more Japanese aircraft would survive and perhaps be ready to attack. Plus a slightly reckless Western would charge by the US carriers, meaning that the Japanese aircraft aren't going to run into the skirmish line of battleships first. And having a much larger cadre of skilled pilots means that instead of arriving and then hanging out for 10-15 minutes trying to sort out formations, the Japanese aircraft can maintain their formation, arrive at target, pile in, and as I said, without the battleships there to screen them, those first couple of waves could at least have done some pretty nasty damage to exposed US carriers, as opposed to what you got historically. Assuming the carriers get their Hellcats up, the Hellcats will still probably horribly maul the Japanese air groups, either in the midst of their actual attack or on their way back, which obviously isn't going to go great for the Japanese. But if you damage or sink a bunch of US carriers, that's probably an overall net win. Mr. Person asks, when ships were slated to go to the breakers, did navies try and squeeze out a final bit of service from them? For example, did they run a lot of gunnery training if the guns were going to be scrapped anyway, and so wearing them out didn't really matter? With guns specifically, not really, because guns and gun barrels can be reused on other ships. So either the entire gun of that particular caliber is going out of service with said navy entirely, like, say, when the last of the standard class being scrapped, then obviously the 14-inch gun is exiting US Navy service, at which point having a bunch of people really well drilled in a gun that's no longer going to be in service is a bit pointless. You might fire off the shots for fun, but it's not going to be a particularly organized thing. Conversely, if the gun is still going to be in service, but it's just those particular ships that are going to the breakers, or the ammunition is. So say, for example, when the South Dakotas and North Carolinas, well, the three that ended up going to the breakers, when they're actually sent off to the breakers, obviously they're not going to be using the 16-inch 45 anymore, but the Mark 8 armor-piercing ammunition can be perfectly used in the Iowa class, at which point there's no point in burning off a bunch of it because you can just take those shells and transfer them over to, you know, something like, say, the Iowas. Or likewise, when the Queen Elizabeths and Revenges are being decommissioned at the end of World War II, the 15-inch guns, or at least a decent number of them, can be retained to provide spares and stock for Vanguard. So again, there's not much point in blazing away with them. And similarly for smaller caliber weapons, if another ship in the fleet is still using them, then you can take them off and make use of them, so don't wear them out. But in more general terms of can you make use of a ship that's about to go to the breakers, yes, navies would usually try and do that. Of course, it depends why the ship's going to the breakers. If it's going to the breakers because it's been pronounced essentially unfit for continued sea service, then you don't want to be doing anything with that because you want the ship to survive to get to the breakers rather than just sinking on the way. But if you have a ship that for whatever reason happens to be no longer fit for frontline service, but fundamentally is still, you know, watertight and machinery works, perhaps it's just out of date or inefficient or surplus to requirements, then yes, very often navies would try and get a final bit of service out of them, usually by turning them into training vessels. So either on a permanent basis, like you would see with the conversion of the Wyoming, or the Navy going, okay, right, the ship is no longer frontline, but we're going to sell it for scrapping in maybe a year or two when it needs a big overhaul to its machinery or something. And in between now and then, we're just going to use it for training new sailors and cadets and so forth and cruising around home waters or something like that. Many Things Left to Build asks, were there any thoughts on switching to 5-inch or 5.25-inch triple or three-gun turrets for the main guns of the Brooklyn, Atlanta, Juno, or Dido class cruisers? For those classes in particular, I'm not aware of any such thoughts. Certainly not with something the size of a Brooklyn. And for the Atlantas and Junos, as far as I'm aware, there weren't any serious design studies for a triple 5-inch 38 mount. Triple mounts, at least for something like the 5-inch 38, will probably actually drop its overall rate of fire, as well as massively complicate the ammunition feed issues, apart from anything else. For the Didos, again, their hull is designed for twin 5.25s, so sticking a triple on there would probably not work. However, I am aware of some programs which did look into triple 5.25 turrets for subsequent designs. So a number of the light cruiser designs that the Royal Navy was sketching up in the latter part of the war before they eventually settled on, well, they went through the iterations that would give you things like what in World of Warships is known as Neptune and the Minotaur, which obviously triple 6-inch and twin 6-inch autoloaders, and then eventually ended up with sticking two Minotaur turrets on a small town class derivative and calling it HMS Tiger, but nonetheless. But just before that, they were looking at a variety of light cruiser designs for what they called the 1944 light cruiser program. And those are listed as having things like 9, 12, or 15 5.25s, which, of course, indicates that they're looking at triple turret mountings for them. Because, okay, yeah, in theory, you could get six twins for the 12 gun, but you can't get 9 or 15 guns unless you're using triples or singles, and no one's dumb enough to use a single at that point. So those were certainly considered. In part because the 5.25 was thought to have some advantages over the 6-inch at that point. It was obviously dual purpose at a point that the 6-inch wasn't. It could fire a lot faster and was easier to make auto reloading than the 6-inch because it was a bit smaller. The bursting charge of the 5.25-inch shell wasn't that much smaller than the 6-inch. And so overall, obviously, if you could deliver more shells to target, you could actually put more weight of explosive on the target. About the only thing the 5.25 had as a major disadvantage was its armor-piercing capability wasn't quite as good. But in the late war environment where it looked like you were going to be more chucking lots of explosive at aircraft and lightly armored ships, it seemed perhaps that this was less of a concern. And this kind of bled out into a variety of other design elements. So the Australians, for example, were looking for new light cruisers as well. And hence why this picture is up here, courtesy of the ever wonderful Zoli, who seems to have sketched almost everything that the Royal Navy and various other navies thought of designing, but didn't end up building. And as you can see here, it's labeled Royal Australian Navy Design 1944 Light Cruiser Proposal. Now, eventually they did kind of look for a little while at a Dido class variant before deciding not to go ahead with the entire thing. But this, which is essentially a modified Crown Colony with triple 5.25s, was one of the front runners for a little while during the design process. And certainly it had a considerable number of advantages over a Dido for a navy that was looking for long distance operations in the Pacific. Apart from anything, it could go considerably further, and it actually had a modicum of anti-torpedo defense. BK Zhong asks, did the Italians or the Germans have similar anti-aircraft heavy light cruiser concepts? Not as kind of specific, hey, we're going to build this particular design of ship as a mainline vessel from the start kind of designs, but both navies did design, and in the German case, technically actually complete, forms of anti-aircraft cruisers. So for the Italians, I would argue actually they came closest to what you might term a traditional or normal anti-aircraft cruiser, in that they were building two small cruisers for the Thai Navy, and then with World War II breaking out and then Italy joining the war, they requisitioned them. You can see one of them here, and they decided that they were going to turn them into small anti-aircraft ships that also happened to be able to do high-speed transport to North Africa. They never actually got around to finishing them before Italy bowed out of the war, and obviously they were conversions of ships that they had on the stocks that were for other purposes, so they weren't a dedicated design from the ground up like the Dido class. But, you know, that's still a reasonable design path to follow. The Germans, on the other hand, as far as I'm aware, never had any specific intention of doing something like an Atlanta or a Dido. But what they did actually do is take a bunch of ships that they had control over that they felt they no longer needed or weren't very useful in their existing roles and convert them into flak ships. Now, they did have a bunch of very small, slow vessels, which they used as flak vessels as well. But in terms of larger ships, more in the kind of cruiser grade of displacement, they took a pair of old World War I era light cruisers that were being used as accommodation hulks, essentially recommissioned them, and converted them into floating flak batteries, which they then used to some reasonable effect. And also, while Eidsvoll and Norway had been destroyed when Norway fell, there were a bunch of older Norwegian coastal defence ships, like the Tordenskjold class, and the Germans actually took those in and completely reconfigured them into floating flak batteries as well. So sometimes when you see pictures of ships like Admiral Scheer, Lützow, Hipper, Scharnhorst and Tirpitz up in Norway, sometimes in the background you can see these rather odd-looking vessels, and those, in fact, are Norwegian coastal defence ships that have then been rebuilt into flak ships. B. Huang asks, there was a Japanese carrier project in 1932 called the Design G5 Light Carrier, which is very mysterious because there's no further documentation on it other than calling for a vessel of 9,800 tons. What are your thoughts about it? As you say, there is precious little other than a designation and a tonnage really known about this, at least in English. I mean, if there are any Japanese listeners out there who happen to know about something that describes more about this design in Japanese, then please let us know. But nonetheless, given the timing and the tonnage and what some of the other more known G-series carrier designs are, I think we can probably come up with some reasonable speculation. So G6 was the predecessor to the G8, which would become the Soryuz. G7, as far as I'm aware, was the plan to convert Ryuho, or to convert a seaplane tender into the light carrier Ryuho. Now, given that obviously G5 theoretically would therefore be a predecessor to that, and if it's dated 1932, then that's probably when the design is either finalized or design work is stopped. So when we consider that as a set of timings, and then we look at Rougeau, the other light carrier, now she was obviously supposed to be under 10,000 tons in order to not break the Washington Treaty, because the Washington Treaty said the aircraft carrier, in part, was a ship that was defined as being over 10,000 tons. So technically speaking, you could make a 9,999-ton aircraft carrier that therefore wouldn't count as an aircraft carrier, or indeed any other kind of ship, so you could build as many of them as you liked. Now, that didn't quite work out with Rougeau. She ended up launching overweight anyway, and then the First London Naval Treaty closed that loophole entirely. But given that they're looking at 9,800 tons, and as we said, work is probably finishing, or the design is being presented in 1932, I think what you're probably looking at there is a successor design to Rougeau, trying to get it right this time, i.e. to get a carrier with a meaningful payload and decent speed on just under 10,000 tons. So it's probably started before the First London Treaty is finalised, and obviously at that point it becomes non-viable to do. But I can think of a couple of reasons why they might have carried that design forward. Firstly, of course, they're still trying to fix issues with Rougeau and her design. So, you know, working out how they might have been able to do it somewhat better would be useful, because then you could try and retro-engineer some of those design changes into Rougeau. But also, like with US and British carrier design proposals, the Japanese might also have been looking at, even if it was now counted as a carrier, perhaps something of around 10,000 tons might be a useful carrier to have. Because, well, in another case of fairly blatant lies. The Japanese had declared Akagi and Kaga to displace just a fraction under 27,000 tons each for the purpose of their aircraft carrier tonnage limitation, which was 81,000 tons total. And that meant that, you know, much like the US considered multiples of various displacements, the Japanese could, while with remaining within the treaty, either build two carriers of roughly 15,000 tons, which is what they ended up doing with the Soryuz, or they could build one 27,000 tonner, which would then leave them with three carriers ostensibly at 27,000 tons or thereabouts, or they could have Akagi and Kaga, and you could just about, if you could get a carrier of around about 9,500 to 9,800 tons, get three such carriers in, which would give you a fleet of five. Now, of course, the London Naval Treaty actually said, no, you can't do that. It just, rather than saying everything that is purpose-built to carry aircraft is a carrier, they actually banned at First London carriers under 10,000 tons. But you can kind of see the logic where the Japanese might have been going with the design before they realized that that ban was in place. Essentially, do we want two big carriers and three small ones, two big carriers and three medium-sized ones, or three big carriers, with the G5s being the three small ones option? Andrew Romash asks, we often hear about shells or bombs striking battleships or cruisers and starting fires. But, unlike aircraft carriers, these ships don't seem to require any significant amount of flammables on board beyond ammunition and fuel, and steel hulls don't usually ignite. And even if the shell hits something flammable, explosions typically tend to scatter and fragment materials rather than ignite them. So, what exactly is burning in these cases, and why? Is it theoretically possible to build a completely fireproof ship? And have there been any serious attempts to do so? Well, I'm sure any Navy would really enjoy a completely fireproof ship, but while not necessarily completely fireproof, there certainly were efforts in, say, World War II, but also just generally when war came, to make ships considerably less fire-prone. So, for example, when you look at the history of APDA Command, one of the things you'll find when ships fall back from the Philippines and they're regrouping the Dutch East Indies is that a huge number of ships are stripping out wooden fixtures, fittings and furniture and sending them ashore because, well, obviously, fire hazard. So ships will try and strip down to be as least flammable as possible, but unfortunately, it's not entirely possible to be completely fireproof. So when something like a battleship or a cruiser is hit, there's actually a long list of things that might catch fire. So obviously most of these ships in World War II would be operating aircraft. Now, if they're operating aircraft, the aircraft themselves can be flammable if they are, you know, canvas or wood partially or fully in construction. Even metal aircraft can burn if the temperature gets hot enough. Then you've got the decks. Obviously, that could be all sorts of things, but usually there's a fair amount of wooden decking involved. Wood can burn, no matter how well it's treated. It just needs enough temperature over enough time to catch fire. You also have the ship's boats, although most of the ship's boats would be landed, some would still be retained for general work. And of course, they tend to be made of wood. And even if they're not, they tend to have internal combustion engines and fuel, which again, you would try and store that fuel away from the boats, but there might be some still in the engines as well as the wooden construction. So if they're hit, that can obviously go up in flames. There's going to be the ship's paint if the heat is enough. And again, heat and time. Most of the paint is ultimately flammable. And particularly when you're looking at bombs, and perhaps to a certain extent shells, the other thing you've got to remember is that above the armoured decks, but obviously either within the superstructure or in the decks that are between the armoured deck and the upper deck, you're going to have the stuff that they're not really putting into the ship citadel, which tends to be things like stores, accommodation, and so forth. Various stores will have flammable packaging or themselves be flammable. Accommodation areas, wardrooms, bunks, cabins, bedding is going to be flammable. Uniforms are going to be flammable. And of course, a lot of things that move are going to be lubricated with things like grease, which can also be flammable, again, if ignited to certain temperatures. And when a bomb or a shell explodes, obviously it scatters very hot bits of itself, which tend to, at least some of the, will embed in the ship. And so they're going to act as long-term high-temperature sources. So even if something isn't ignited by the immediate explosion, those hot bits of metal can sit there and cause fires to break out shortly thereafter. Redosaurus asks, if the US Navy had a larger focus on the North African, Italian and European theatres, would the Dauntless have been successful as a close air support plane? Sadly, I think if you use Dauntlesses en masse in the European theatre, I don't think they'd see huge amounts of success, certainly not to the extent that they did in the Pacific theatre. And that's for two main reasons. Firstly, if you use them against, you know, the European continent or, as you say, in North Africa, you're putting them up against a fairly substantial amount of land-based forces, whereas when the Dauntless is being used for the most part in the Pacific, it's either being used against a very fixed, limited amounts of enemy aircraft in terms of carrier air wings, and obviously usually even a subset of that, because it's usually the combat air patrol that they're fighting. And when they're being used in attack mode that's not against carriers, it's against usually islands which have, a limited number of aircraft and a limited number of airfields. Whereas going into the North African, Italian or Northern European theatres, you're up against considerably more aircraft on considerably more airfields. And as we know, generally speaking, land-based fighters will tend to have a slight performance edge over naval-based equivalents. And so obviously that would also be a problem. You know, if you can, in carrier warfare terms, if you can bypass the combat air patrol or the fighters escorting you can tangle with that combat air patrol, you then have something of a clear run at the target. There might be a few fighters that break through to come at you, and obviously the ship's anti-aircraft guns will fire at you. But by and large, in those circumstances, there's not going to be too many fighters coming after you. Whereas in the European theatre, if you're going against land-based targets, then sure, the combat air patrol or the escort might strip away the first enemy fighter squadron that comes after you. But what about the second, the third and the fourth that are coming up from different airfields? And that loops me round to another issue, which is that in terms of wing loading, top speed, cruising speed, altitude, etc., the performance of the average Dauntless is actually very similar to the performance of the average Ju-87 Stuka. So, as we know, in the early part of the war, the Stukas were very effective as long as the Luftwaffe had air dominance. But the minute Stukas started to run into significant aerial opposition, they tended to get shot down quite easily. And really, the only major performance advantage that the Dauntless has over the Stuka in terms of can it fight off incoming intercepted aircraft or intercepting aircraft is that they've got two rifle caliber machine guns in the rear gunner position instead of one. The wing loading indicates that actually theoretically some Stukas might even be more agile than a Dauntless, although that's the very early models. To be fair, by the later models, they're definitely going to be somewhat less agile. But although obviously the Dauntless has a reputation of being surprisingly agile for a bomber, a dive bomber specifically, and quite tough, a Stuka in a European environment where it's being intercepted by Focke-Wulf 190s and Bf 109s, if the Wildcats and or Hellcats don't hold them off, the Dauntless is going to be quite vulnerable. Quite a few different people all asked versions of the same question, which was, why didn't the US Navy just stick with the Dauntless once its successor's issues had become very clear? There's a reasonably wide variety of reasons, one of which is that, yes, the SB-2C undoubtedly was an awful aircraft initially. However, there were quite a few aircraft that had gone on to actually be quite successful during the war, which frankly had been pretty abysmal when they'd first entered service. I mean, even something as legendary in American circles as the P-51, the P-51A, for what it was designed to do, frankly sucked. Yes, a lot of the issues were solved by going, okay, get rid of that Allison engine and stick a Merlin in it. There was a little bit more to it than that as well, but the whole Mustang debacle was actually taking place, roughly speaking, a year before the first operational combat debut of the SB-2C. And that, as well as, you know, as I say, various other examples, and the fact there was a very long list of changes that the US Navy wanted made to the new HAL Diver, meant that I suspect a lot of thinking went, okay, yeah, it sucks at the moment, but we've got experience with this. We tell them what they needs to be changed, and hopefully once all those things have been changed, the resulting aircraft will be a lot better. And they did, in theory, want something that was faster, more heavily armed, and critically longer ranged than the Dauntless, because, you know, during the video that I did on the Dauntless, you'll notice how many times Dauntlesses ended up either in the drink or coming in with fumes left in their tanks because of range limitations, especially in a war like the Pacific. So if you're being offered an aircraft that theoretically can fly considerably further, even if it currently is kind of a bit of a terrible aircraft, if you think you can fix it, then you're probably going to keep going with that because of the utility that it offers if you can make it work. The other problem, of course, is that there's a huge amount of industrial inertia involved in switching aircraft from one to another, because it's not just a case of going, okay, we've got SB2Cs in service now, we can stop production of the Dauntless, because you would place an order for however many hundred Dauntlesses. That has to be accepted, payment has to be made, and aircraft have to be built. And all of that takes time, as does deliveries. So when you're looking at the last SBDs being built in kind of spring, summer 1944, the cutoff for saying, okay, these are the last SBDs we're going to be ordering, had to take place considerably before then, at a point when, in theory, they were thinking, okay, the revised design SB2Cs are coming online about now, so in theory these should work, and so we need to start thinking about terminating Dauntless orders so that we don't end up with parallel production lines and wasted effort. And then it turns out that the revised SB2C actually still sucked quite a bit. Now, to be fair, there were still further revisions to the SB2C, which meant that by the end of the war it sucked somewhat less. But yeah, with a crystal ball, I think there's some argumentation that maybe a Super Dauntless or an SBD-678 could have been ordered if they'd known exactly how bad the Hell Diver was going to end up, but they didn't have said crystal ball. The man formerly known as Commenting Is What I Do asks, I was recently getting into the series Altamare, a series that's an alternate history where the Fourth Crusade actually heads to Egypt. And in the build-up episodes where they plan the crusade and when they're negotiating with Venice's merchants, it seems to me that travel through the Mediterranean seems unreasonably complex and expensive. Maybe it's my own World War II era understanding of travel, but even at the slow speeds of World War II submarines, which are comparable to ships with sails in the era, crossing the Mediterranean should be a rather quick and easy journey. What am I misunderstanding about the undertaking of such an expedition that makes it a far more daunting task for the Crusaders? Oh, there's a lot of things. I'm actually going to go into it in a lot more detail in an episode I have planned for the early part of 2026, about a rather famous sail period voyage that ends in disastrously in a shipwreck, but that happens in the Med. But the short version is, well, look at this, or just look up any detailed chart that is of the prevailing winds in the Mediterranean. They're all over the place. Now, couple that with the fact that, obviously, for something like a crusade, you've got to worry about hostile shipping in certain areas. You've also got to factor in that during part of the year, especially for that period, the Mediterranean is just a no-go zone. You know, if you sail in the Mediterranean in, roughly speaking, late autumn through early spring, you are looking to die very horribly, especially when the really big storms get up. Outside of that, you can still get very nasty storms, and although these are the prevailing winds, they're not necessarily always going to be blowing this way. So that can be an additional complicating factor. And if the wind is calm, then obviously you're not going anywhere. If the wind gets particularly strong, you need to start dodging islands and coastlines, which can also be a problem. Then you've got the fact that ships of, even by the period of the Fourth Crusade, they're not really set up for particularly long distance travel. And even a World War II submarine can actually move around considerably faster than they can, because a World War II sub, the only time it's going to be at a speed that's comparable to a Fourth Crusade era transport vessel under sail is going to be when it's creeping along on its electric motors. If a submarine, World War II sub, underwater at full speed on its electric motors or close to it, is probably going to be moving 50 to 100% faster than the average age of sail transport ship in the Middle Ages, it would be. And then, of course, submarines spend a fair amount of time on the surface where they can move even faster still, and they can move independent of the wind. So you've got very fickle winds that are going all over the place. You're not going to be taking a particularly direct route, and you've got to worry about hostile interdiction on the way. So even using this very basic map, if you look at, let's say this, let's assume they're starting in Venice and you want to get to Egypt, this is actually one of the slightly simpler routes. You have to sail down the Adriatic, then southwest towards Sicily, going basically past the lower part of Italy. And then you catch the main trade winds that send you kind of southeast, east-southeast across the Mediterranean. Then you kind of bump across the top of what's now Libya and you end up in Egypt. That is actually pretty much the route that, for example, the Roman grain trade used to take, except, of course, not coming from the Adriatic. They'd come down the west side of Italy through the Straits of Messina and then down to Egypt. But then they'd have to go kind of, roughly speaking, up towards Asia Minor and then across past Greece to get back, because obviously you can't sail back the way you've come because, well, the wind's going the other way. So factor in that you're going to have to be putting in for food and water quite regularly as you work your way around Italy, and then you're going to have to make what for the time is a fairly perilous jump from either Sicily or Malta across to North Africa. And there you're very unlikely to find all that much in the way of friendly ports. So at that point, you might want to consider perhaps a slightly different route. Obviously, I don't know in the Ultima series exactly how far westwards Islamic expansion has gotten at that point. But if we assume for the sake of argument that these areas are still relatively friendly, an alternate route that is both shorter in terms of individual hops and therefore also gets you more food and water rests closer to your target would be from Sicily to hop over eastwards to Greece and then to Crete. And then you can try and sail south, roughly speaking, from Crete and then catch the last bits of the trade winds and head to Egypt. That will get you your last kind of regular food and water stop considerably closer to Egypt, assuming that Crete is still friendly. But of course, with a limited number of possible routes and therefore those routes being known, if you've got hostile elements that you're coming to fight, they can potentially put corsairs, raiders, or whole war fleets waiting for you. So you've got a lot of intel to work out. Plus, of course, Italy is a bunch of city-states and all the various politics going on. So yes, you might be the Fourth Crusade, but not necessarily everybody who isn't on the Islamic side of the Crusade is going to be particularly happy to see you. Example, at the Battle of Lepanto, there's no French involvement because the French at that point are allied with the Ottomans. Although, admittedly, that is somewhat later than the Fourth Crusade, but still, you get an idea of how the political situation can shake out. It all adds up to actually a very slow rate of progress if you're trying to get through the Mediterranean at that time period. You'd actually be probably slightly faster trying to deploy if you were a Roman fleet back in the classic age of the Roman Empire, because at least at that point, most, if not all, the Mediterranean was pretty much under their control, so at least you didn't have to worry about being interdicted all that much. Brendan Buersdorf asks, what was Portugal's most powerful sailing vessel? Did they ever have a first-rate ship of the line? Now, Portuguese viewers, feel free to jump in if I've missed something, but as far as I'm aware, the Portuguese Navy never had a 100-plus gun three-decker first-rate ship of the line. The closest they seem to have come is this ship that you can see kind of front and centre, in later known as the Príncipe Real. Initially known as, I apologise to Portuguese listeners, but I am trying, Nossa Senhora de Conceição. I think that's how the Portuguese version would be pronounced. Some of my Spanish may be coming through a little bit there, but nonetheless. Anyway, this was a 90-gun two-decker, so in British terms, she would be a second-rate. And she was later slightly reduced in armament as time went on because, you know, heavier guns and modernization and all that lot. But she served in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. But in terms of what was Portugal's most powerful sailing ship, well, I think that's somewhat relative, because while this ship was Portugal's individually most powerful sailing ship, as far as I'm aware, of course, there were plenty of 100-plus gun first-rate ships of the line, which she would struggle in fighting. Conversely, if you wheel back the clock a couple of hundred years to the time of the Spanish Armada, when Spain is making one of its periodic attempts to make Portugal Western Spain, they take over the Portuguese fleet, and a reasonable number of some of the biggest and most powerful ships in the Spanish Armada are in fact ex-Portuguese vessels. And I'd argue at that point, you could pick from two or three of such vessels and argue that those are probably the most powerful sailing ships relative to everybody else at the time that Portugal has ever produced, because, yeah, they pretty much were one-on-one going to be some of the biggest and meanest things out there. Alan Hulk asks, how about a video on USS Iowa's turret explosion? Now, you see, this is one of those few incidents where I pretty much have to say I'm exceptionally unlikely to ever do a video on this. Not because I don't think I could do it justice to a certain degree. I think I could probably do a decentish video on it, but while it obviously does involve USS Iowa, which is a ship that was built during the period the channel covers, it is, of course, an incident that occurs much, much later in her service career, well past the point that the channel covers. And, of course, I have a standing policy of, if I'm covering items specifically well past when the channel coverage period stops, like a 1989 turret explosion, then I would rather get somebody who is a subject matter expert on that issue to come in and, you know, be interviewed on the channel rather than me trying to piece things together. There's also the fact, obviously, it is still something that's occurred within a lot of people's living memory. It's a highly emotionally charged incident. There are a lot of shenanigans involved in the investigation afterwards, as much as I'll say for the minute. And honestly, when I used to think about maybe doing a video like that, in 2022, I visited USS Iowa. And when I was talking to some of the docents, curators, people in charge of the ship, etc., on board, then I kind of mentally came to the idea and sort of kind of agreed with them that, honestly, the battleship Iowa Channel has done, I think, a couple of fairly extensive videos on the subject. They, of course, have access to the ship itself. They have somewhat easier access to all the various records, such as can be accessed in the first place, and obviously direct access to people who served on board. Indeed, at least one of the people who is kind of very senior in Iowa's leadership actually served aboard the ship, and in the US Navy generally. So in terms of a definitive, this is what happened, or as far as we can piece together, this is the most likely course of events that happened, I'm not really going to be able to improve on what they did. At which point, you know, kind of like my position on doing a video directly about the Battle of Midway or the attack on Pearl Harbor, I haven't done those battles specifically because I want to be able to add something, either in the form of new research or a new way of presenting it, beyond what's already been done, rather than just being another video about this thing. So, yeah, considering that it's very unlikely I'm going to be able to top what the Battleship Iowa's channel's already done, I'm afraid I'm going to have to take a principled pass at doing that particular video. Unless, of course, as I say, somebody who has done an awful lot of work about the turret explosion wanted to be interviewed about it, at which point I would, of course, give them a platform. Vinve asks, in the diary of Samuel Pepys on Friday 14th of March 1662, there's a mention of a certain Dr. Kufler's engine to blow up ships. Do we know what this was? So for those of you who don't have access to Pepys's diary, I'll read the relevant extract from the entry. So it says, "In the afternoon came the German doctor Kufler to discourse with us about his engine to blow up ships. We doubted not the matter of fact, it being tried in Cromwell's time, but the safety of carrying them in ships. But he do tell us that when he comes to tell the king his secret, for none but the king successively and their heirs must know it, it will appear to be of no danger at all." Now, we don't know for certain what this is, because it seems that the amount of money that Kufler wanted for his secret was considered too high, and therefore it kind of just died off. However, what we do know is that Kufler's father-in-law was one Cornelius van Drebbel, who, as you might guess from the picture that's accompanying this question, actually invented a rowed submarine made of wood and leather, which actually stayed underwater for a reasonable amount of time back in that time period. However, the submarine itself cannot be the secret. It might be tempting because, of course, in the entry it says the engine to blow up ships. But you've got to remember that back then, the use of the word engine doesn't mean what it means to us today. Yes, it still meant something that either moves or causes movement, but that isn't necessarily something that drives something else to movement regularly. You could, for example, in the modern mindset, conceive of this oared submarine being called an engine. But when you look into descriptions of the period, it could be stuff that makes other stuff move very violently. So, for example, you get siege engines. There's no motive power usually outside of gravity and torsion, but their main effect is destruction. And similarly, things like petards and underground mines were often also called engines, because although it was just human power stuck in gunpowder, yeah, they did tend to make things move quite violently, even if it was only for a short period of time. And also, of course, you have this reference to the secret, this engine, whatever it is, being carried in ships, which obviously a large submarine, it would be carried on the deck of a ship, if at all, and it would also be somewhat obvious. So, and there's also the thing about safety. So, you know, the leather and wood submarine with oars, there's nothing inherently unsafe about carrying that on a ship. There would be something inherently unsafe about carrying large amounts of gunpowder not in the magazines. And so given that there's a reference to it being tried in Cromwell's time, well, we don't have any specific records, as far as I'm aware, in the English Civil War of people trying to blow up each other's ships with explosive mines. But there are several uses or attempted uses of what we would today recognise as timed bombs during the English Civil War. And I think, and most people who over the years have come to a similar conclusion, that what is being referred to here is some form of watertight timed gunpowder bomb, aka a mine, or perhaps in more modern parlance, a limpet charge, which would then be attached to the target ship in question by some means. And then after a certain amount of time, it would explode and blow up the ship. Now, obviously, that could be done by several different methods in the very early period when mines kind of reappear again around about the Napoleonic period. There's various discussions for towing them on a streaming line that kicks out from one side of the ship, or having two ships tow a cable with a mine between them, or just leaving them to drift in with the tide on timers, or indeed, obviously, what will eventually become the spar torpedo. So it's conceivable that perhaps it was designed to work with this rowed submarine, but also, obviously, to be carried around on warships as well. The main secret there would presumably have been some kind of waterproofing, reliable waterproofing for a gunpowder charge, along with a relatively robust timer of some description, which could then set off said mine. Gunnery officer asks, what would happen if US Task Force 58 was out of position or encountered very bad weather that prevented them from launching their airstrikes on Yamato and her task force during the Tengo operation? Would the British Pacific Fleet carriers instead have launched an attack on Yamato? And do you think British carrier aircraft could have done a better job than the US carrier aircraft, since the British air crew would have been more experienced and battle-hardened than the US ones? It would be physically possible for the British carriers to pull off a strike on Yamato if there was enough notice. From where they were attacking the Sakishima Islands to a launch position of about the same distance to Yamato as where Task Force 58 historically was, but somewhat to the west, would be about 11 to 12 hours of hard steaming at high speed. So given that the US aircraft carriers started launching about 10-ish in the morning of the 7th of April, and the Japanese formation was spotted leaving Japan in the late afternoon of the previous day, and US submarines were reporting this, there is a reasonable time window where if there was some kind of, you know, typhoon or very unseasonable weather or something that meant that Task Force 58's aircraft operations were just not possible. Spruance, theoretically, if he'd called up the British Pacific Fleet around about 7, 8 in the evening and gone, look, you need to hightail it north. We need you to launch airstrikes, presumably somewhat to the west of this weather position, this weather, in order to take out Yamato. He could have done it, but I mean, it does raise one very big question, which is that the distance to that hypothetical launch point would have been less for the forces of Task Force 58 to cover. So why weren't they going there? Although I suppose you could make some argument about if the weather was really, really rough, maybe their transit speed would be reduced. They're having to run at very low speeds to not bash their ships up or something like that. It's physically possible that the British Pacific Fleet could have redeployed in time to intercept Yamato at, roughly speaking, the same time that historically the US aircraft did. As for whether the British aircrew were more experienced and battle-hardened than the US ones, I think that would very much depend on a case-by-case basis, because some of the Fleet Air Arm pilots aboard the British Pacific Fleet would have been relatively new, the same as some of the pilots on the US forces, but some of the other pilots in US carrier forces might have been flying on a fairly constant basis since the beginning of the Pacific War, which would make them pretty hardcore pilots by that point in time, the same as there would obviously be some Fleet Air Arm pilots who had been flying since the beginning of the war in Europe, which would make them also veterans. You've also got to remember that Spruance was also capable of marshalling a battle fleet of, you know, straight-up battleships to intercept Yamato, and they would also be much closer and on hand, and indeed would have, I think, been his first preference, given that Mitcher had to argue for the release of the carriers. So, I mean, you could, in theory, make an argument that maybe the weather would be affecting the battleships almost as much. I mean, obviously, they're slightly more durable than the carriers, but still. But I think the most likely outcome of some kind of weather system preventing air operations that also somehow prevents Task Force 58 from just relocating to launch airstrikes from a slightly different place would have been sending in the US battleships. But if that was the case, there is a possibility that Spruance may well have called up the British Pacific Fleet to assist with that, to get their hits in first, or get their hits in support of the US battleships. Because, hey, if you've got air power that you can call up, it, that's better than not having it. Because even if you're confident in your battleship's ability to drown Yamato in gunfire, a damaged Yamato goes down faster, which means it has less time to hit back. About the only thing I would say that will probably be definitely different about a British airstrike on Yamato compared to an American one is that the British carriers, regardless of exact air group sizes, but British doctrine for taking on capital ships centered pretty much exclusively around torpedoing them and using fighters to suppress anti-air defences. So it would have been a much more torpedo-weighted strike, as opposed to the historic US one, which obviously went in with bombs as much as it did with torpedoes. But it certainly would be an interesting scenario to have seen play out. Patrick Donnelly asks, which carrier operations in World War II could be used for a Top Gun-style movie? I think it very much depends on which half of the Top Gun movie you want to focus on, because there isn't really anything that would perfectly match the Top Gun movie plot setup, specifically because in World War II, they're at war, so you can't have this kind of should we, shouldn't we, how do we exactly do we confront enemy aircraft kind of stuff that you get at the beginning, which is kind of the drive for it all. And obviously training during World War II to get new pilots out there was not rushed, but it was certainly a lot more accelerated than it had been in peacetime. And obviously, again, the Top Gun movie is set in peacetime. With that said, if you wanted to focus more on the, you know, combat pilot coming back to training facility back ashore and having difficulty in integrating into the training regimens and, you know, trying to pass knowledge on while also perhaps having to experience new things, I think you could probably do something around late 1942 in the US, because then you could have pilots coming back from USS, ironically enough, given the setting of the Top Gun movie, USS Enterprise, after the Battle of Eastern Solomons, when Carrier Group 6 is essentially removed from Enterprise and Carrier Group 10 is put in place. Now, some Carrier Group 6 pilots obviously head back out into the fight, but others do head shoreside. And that could be kind of the driving factor, because at that point, those pilots will have probably seen both Midway and Eastern Solomons, and they'll be constantly getting news in over the course of the latter part of the year about Enterprise herself fighting at Santa Cruz, the loss of Hornet at Santa Cruz, the loss of Wasp to torpedoes, the fact that Saratoga's been hit and torpedoed, but obviously not sunk. So that's going to add a lot of pressure to everything that's going on. And then you could perhaps cycle them back out to sea again for the Battle of the Philippine Sea. And so perhaps one of the challenges that may be introduced during the film would be a Wildcat pilot who's like, oh no, this is my good trusty Wildcat. I don't like it to be replaced, having to come to terms with the fact that actually the F-6F Hellcat is just flat out better. Whereas if you want this kind of scrappy, somewhat outnumbered, everything is going wrong but we've got to do our duty element of the latter part of the Top Gun movie, then I would suggest doing one of the big British carrier operations as part of the Malta convoys, because yeah, if you want a handful of pilots desperately going up against hordes of enemies with the ship, you know, literally exploding around them in some cases, and having to use every possible trick in the book to try and make sure that things don't end horribly badly, that would be my go-to. Nosdormu89 asks, what if the United States had built the original six frigates as ships of the line instead of frigates? Nothing fancy like a first rate, either higher-end fourth rates or lower-end third rates, keeping the same design principles but just upsizing. How do you see the Naval War of 1812 and the ships' respective careers going somewhat differently? Well, going roughly by the size and armament of the original six frigates, I could see perhaps the Constitution, United States, and President being built as either 74s or maybe 80 gunners, depending on how much information the US has managed to get off the French before you end up with the quasi-war and stuff like that. And then the three smaller ones would perhaps be built as 64s or something like that. At which point you'd probably be looking at 32-pounder lower gun decks and then probably either 18 or 24-pounder upper gun decks. So that would make them fairly heavily armed. We're talking about the three big ones at that point. they would have some comparable ships in the British and French and other navies, but there would also be, you know, 74s that with 32 pounder and 12 pounder decks, or 32 and 18s. There's actually quite a few of those, as opposed to 32 and 24s. And there are even some that are 24 pounder and 18 pounder, or 24 and 12 pounder, especially when you get down to the 64 gunners. Now, the fun thing about that is that for the War of 1812, the ships' careers, I think, would start out better, but ultimately end up somewhat worse, because they are obviously therefore more valuable ships, more expensive. They cost more in both money and manpower to crew, and therefore they're going to be far more prestigious. However, they are also, being ships of the line, not as easy prey from the British perspective as half a dozen frigates. And when the War of 1812 kicks off, spoiler alert, in 1812, Britain has a lot of its attention, especially a lot of its capital ships' attention, focused on France. Now, that doesn't stop them showing up with some capital ships, 74s, third rates, but they are, relatively speaking, few and far between, and generally acting as flagships of various blockade stations and so forth. And in that respect, I don't think the US would be having their frigates as scattered as they historically were. They would probably be operating them in one or two squadrons. And therefore, as I said, that would make them initially in something of a better state, because let's say the three big ones are concentrated in a squadron. Three fairly hefty third rates could easily blow their way through a standard British blockading squadron and either destroy or capture most of the ships. And realistically, at that point, I don't think the British can afford to send the dozen or so third rates they'd need to send in order to blockade the US forces, because if they have them distributed in two squadrons, then ideally you want at least four or so third rates off of each port. Now, if you've got 364s in one squadron, 374s or 80s in the other, then maybe you want four off of one and three off of the other. But of course, you've got to be able to cycle ships. So that's why I say you'd need about a dozen third rates just blockading the ports where those ships of the line actually are. And the reason I say don't distribute them is because, yes, in theory, you could argue, well, if you have one at each port, then you'd need a dozen just to do the blockade, and then that means two dozen. But the problem there is that at that point, the British might be tempted to go, okay, we'll put a third rate off of each one, and then maybe some smaller ships, some of the fourth rates and some of their own 64s, as just firepower supplements, because between that and some blockading frigates, you would in theory have enough firepower to overwhelm any single US ship of the line. So initially, their freedom of operation would be much greater, and of course, with that kind of firepower, you could maybe try and hunt down enemy convoys, and of course try and hunt down full-scale enemy warships. But the reason why I say it would probably end up worse for them towards the end is because as the war progresses, you get to the temporary peace before the final end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815, and that's when the US coast gets really shut down by massive Royal Navy forces. And in those circumstances, that's where you would end up potentially with whole squadrons of British ships of the line just waiting for them to come out. And recrewing three third rates after an extended period blockaded in port would be a lot, lot harder than recrewing a single frigate. And of course, a full-on fleet engagement, while it would be very, very interesting, if it's a loss, it's far more of a loss for the US than losing a frigate. Nathan Redder asks, when and how did the decline of the Russian Navy start? Were they doing all right and then they caught communism and nosedived, or were they slowly declining and communism just happened to hasten the process? The Russian Navy in some ways is a longer and more protracted example of also what happened to the US Navy for a good chunk of its existence. Except that with the US Navy, it was a case of, there's war, everybody will pour tons of money into the Navy. It's peacetime. Congress will now steal all your money and refuse to give you anything. And back and forth and back and forth and back and forth goes until, well, basically the mid part of the 20th century. Now, when it comes to the Russians, to a certain extent, there is financial considerations to keep in mind, but there's also two other major problems. Firstly, of course, is the fact that Russia can't have a navy for most of its history, simply because it's got interest to defend in the Baltic, in the Black Sea, and in the Pacific. And then just as the time period that the channel covers begins to wrap up, also the Northern Fleet starts to come about. But while you could theoretically later on just about get ships to transit between those various fleets, back in the more classical Age of Sail period, and even to a certain extent in the Ironclad period, it just wasn't that practical to build a ship in the Baltic and then send it to the Black Sea. You could do it, but it was such a massive undertaking, it would just be cheaper to build a ship in the Black Sea if that's where you wanted the ship to be. Also, political considerations around the Dardanelles. But the other big factor is that Russia as a state doesn't need a navy per se. It needs a navy or navies if it wants to project its interests beyond its borders and so forth. However, as an existential need, Russia doesn't actually need a navy. Certainly for most of the time period that the channel covers, technically speaking, shore fortifications and maybe some coastal defence ships for stuff like food trade in the Sea of Azov, and the Russians would be absolutely fine. They're one of the least vulnerable countries when it comes to naval blockade. And so that means you get times when you have perhaps more outward-looking monarchs like Peter the Great, and the Russian navy gets a big boost, and then subsequent monarchs who don't care quite as much, and the navy plummets back down again. And so it oscillates very much like the US Navy did. However, I would say if I had to pinpoint any one single place where the Russian Navy's decline really started, it would probably actually be the Crimean War. Because during the classic Age of Sail, while the Russian fleet's fortunes waxed and waned, they were always reckoned to at least be a decent local power. So yeah, you weren't going to be too worried about Russian warships in the Atlantic, but if you wanted to operate in the Baltic or the Black Sea, you did definitely have to take them into account. But just as ships were getting a lot bigger and a lot more expensive, and you're beginning to teeter on the edge of the Ironclad Age, although it's not quite at that point, you get the Crimean War, and you get the two largest navies in the world showing up on Russia's doorstep, and most of the big Russian ships, especially in the Black Sea, just go, nope, we're not even going to try and fight them, and most of the ships end up scuttled. And that, I think, is a big hit for both the pride of the Russian Navy, in that they've just basically gone and sunk most of their fairly expensive fleet without even trying to fight in the most cases. And it also means that they're having to build back up again from not quite scratch, but almost from scratch. And then that combined with the rather rapid advance of technology in the late 19th century means that they don't have a base to build from in terms of fleet numbers, so they're forever playing catch up. Russia's a little bit slower on the industrialization uptick as well. So while they do come up with some rather interesting designs during the Ironclad and then the pre-dreadnought and dreadnought period, you are constantly seeing issues coming up. The fact that, you know, for example, when it comes to pre-dreadnoughts, the Russians end up reaching out to the French to basically catch them up on how to build pre-dreadnoughts and so forth. And again, you still see some flashes of good design coming through here and there, but they are desperately, desperately playing catch up. And then just as it looks like they might, perhaps in the late 1900s, early 1910s, begin to be at least getting on a par technologically, if not numerically, with the other navies, then, of course, communism comes along. And the Leninist version of communism declares that, well, you know, having an education is a bourgeoisie concept. And you know who has an education? Naval officers. You know what naval officers also are? Mostly nobility. What do communists hate? Nobility, rich people, people with an education. Most of Russia's naval officer corps is all three. And then you discover why running a warship via collective bargaining doesn't actually work very well. And then as you get to the end of the time period that the channel covers, basically to survive, to be an officer in the late 30s, and then obviously World War II, Russian Navy, you have to be as good at playing dodgeball with the purges and the various political reliability checks as you need to be actually a good naval officer. Of course, World War II does allow for a certain amount of meritocracy to shine through, because you might be really, really, really loyal to the party, but in that crucible, if you're a pretty terrible commander of a ship or a submarine, you are going to die horribly and very fast. Because, Stukas do not care how loyal you are to Comrade Stalin. And then, of course, that sets the stage for the Cold War and the end of the time period the channel covers. And finally, for this slightly extended first dry dock of 2026, 31 Knott Burke, Chief of Naval Operations, asks, how do the Scharnhorst class compare with the Alaska class in terms of performance and role? So I have mentioned this a few times in various dry docks, but very briefly, they are very different ships, despite the fact that they kind of superficially can appear similar at first glance. The Scharnhorst are far more heavily protected than the Alaskas. Both ships are relatively swift, and of course both ships have 9 guns. The Scharnhorst have 11-inch guns, the Alaskas have 12-inch. But the Alaskas are designed primarily, and somewhat ironically, to counter Japanese supercruisers that didn't actually exist, but Allied intelligence was fairly convinced did exist. And then the existence of the Alaskas actually triggered the Japanese to start designing the very supercruisers the Alaskas were originally designed against. So they actually caused their own enemies to retroactively appear to a certain degree. The Scharnhorsts were designed as capital ships first and foremost. Yes, they were somewhat underarmed for capital ships of the period, but that was more a political consideration than, strictly speaking, what the German Navy at the time absolutely would have preferred. And yes, of course, they did end up engaging in a certain amount of commerce raiding, but honestly, that was pretty much all the German Navy was really ever going to do in terms of its surface fleet, given the relative strength compared to its enemies at the start of World War II. Of course, they did support the invasion of Norway as well, but it turned out one Renown class was enough to make them run away from that. Although, again, how much of that was Hitler's orders and how much of that was the relative fighting qualities, well, that's probably for a discussion around Lofoten. Now, the Alaska class have fewer issues once they go into service. They are expensive to run compared to what you get in terms of manpower and money versus fighting power, compared to, for a slightly greater cost, you can run an Iowa. But they are reasonable at sea keeping and so forth, whereas of course the Scharnhorst have fairly major issues when they're initially launched, and even with the Atlantic bow it doesn't solve those issues entirely. And of course the Alaskas are a far more modern design than the Scharnhorsts, because, well, they're just built a lot later. But if you want kind of the short form version, I would say the Scharnhorst and the Dunkirks are small capital ships, and the Alaskas are very large cruisers, and they're kind of comfortably, but still close to the edge of that dividing line, with the Alaskas being on the cruiser side and the Scharnhorst and the Dunkirks being on the capital ship side. And that's it for this week's episode of the Dry Dock. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.